Octavia Butler has unusual credentials for a science fiction writer. She's won a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award, and her stories take the science fiction genre into uncharted realms, even for science fiction, or as it's sometimes now called, fantastic realism. Her works focus on power, gender, family, and race. In fact, Butler's real-world skin color makes her a fantastic story. Female science fiction writers are rare. Black female science fiction writers are so rare as to practically be a category of one, and that one is Octavia Butler. But her work stands out for more than the fact that she is black. Her writing has won science fiction's top awards, the Nebula, the Hugo, and the Locus. The power of Butler's work is in her character development. Her characters are often independent women who use their minds and strength, but not their sexuality, to win the day. Her first work was Pattern Master. It tells the story of a world split between a telepathic ruling class and two other groups, the mute humans who serve them and the Clayarchs, four-legged creatures from outer space. Then there is her book Kindred, in which a modern-day black woman travels back in time to save a white slave master who is her ancestor. In Parable of the Sower, Butler writes about smart pills, drought, and sociopaths taking over Southern California. Her most recent novel continues that story with her heroine, Lauren Olamina, a black woman who must make a future in that terrible landscape. It's called Parable of the Talents. Octavia Butler has made a future for a shy, awkward child herself. She joins me. Octavia Butler, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
If you want to join the conversation, our number here is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. Ms. Butler, let's begin by asking about your latest book. The title is Parable of the Talents. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
And what is that a reference to?
Well, it's a reference to the biblical parable, which is really one of the rougher biblical parables, about the fact that we had better, if we are going to have any success at all as Christians or as people, use what talents we have, invest them, and make the best of them.
How does that then play out in the story? What is the story?
This is the second half of a kind of fictional biography. I have wanted for a long time to write the fictional biography of someone who, after death, might be thought of as a kind of god. And it would have to be after death because this woman is imperfect enough for no one to make that mistake while she's living. But I wanted her to be a person who begins a new belief system, a new religion, and who does it in response to the times in which she is born, the difficulties and the fact that people are very much without hope, the poor people are anyway, during her lifetime. And what she comes up with is this belief system that she believes will put them on a path to something better.
Well, then I guess we have to go back and tell the listeners a little bit about the previous book, Parable of the Sorrows. Now, what was that title?
Parable of the Sower.
Sower. So
yes.
What was that title referring to?
Another biblical parable. The parable of the sower is the parable of a man who goes out to sow some seed, to plant some seed, and some of it falls onto the rocks and doesn't grow, and some of it falls among the weeds and is choked by the weeds, and the birds eat some of it, and the rest grows and multiplies a hundredfold or a thousandfold. And that is what my character and her few friends manage to do, in a sense. They lose absolutely everything. They very nearly lose their lives. And then they begin to put their lives back together again. And because my character has this belief system, and because she seems to be going somewhere when all the rest of them aren't quite sure where they should go or how they should get there, she is leading them. This doesn't mean that she knows a lot more than they do. It just means that what she does know, she believes in.
Well, you know, what strikes me here is that you have your character living in a world where there's smart pills, where, and in fact, I think, you know, we're on the verge of having smart pills in America today. But you have her living in a
That's
world...
That's a little frightening, isn't it?
But it's true.
Yeah.
But you have her living in this world where there are these smart pills. You also have her living in a world where there's drought, and we know from the heating up of the world, that global warming, that there is an increased chance of drought these days. You also have her dealing with an increased number of gangs and sociopaths, and I think there are lots of people who would argue that we are dealing with that in the world today. Mm-hmm. It sounds almost as if you have simply projected on the basis of current events to create your fantasy world.
I have, in a very real sense. And the smart pills, by the way, were not presented as something that people should rush out and get in the book. The way they are presented is that my character's mother was addicted to them, and as a result, she has a birth defect. So they're certainly not presented as something that people should be on the lookout for.
Well, Although, hang on a second. What do you mean a birth defect? I think, in fact, she's very smart.
Yes. Oh, I didn't say that she wasn't smart, but she has a problem. She has a kind of delusionary defect that causes her to believe that she feels the pain of other people. She feels pain that she sees other people enduring. It is a delusion. It is a dangerous delusion because it prevents her, or could prevent her, from protecting herself in a very violent world. It's a kind of biological conscience on the one hand. You know, she can't give pain without receiving it. But on the other hand, it means that when she's attacked, she's in much more trouble than someone else might be.
Well, in fact, one of the things that strikes me about the telling of this tale is that you see her as extraordinarily sympathetic, and yet she is viewed as defective by others around her.
She's viewed as defective by herself, and it really is a defect. She would physically certainly be better off without it. I began writing the book with the thought that maybe what we needed was a biological conscience. It does seem to me that there are too many people in this world who would just as soon wipe out half their country if they could rule the other half. We keep running across them, and they keep starting wars.
Like, who are you talking about?
Oh, I'm thinking of the former Yugoslavia. I'm thinking of several countries in Africa and the former Soviet Union. This kind of thing keeps happening, where you have people who, they don't have a wonderful new philosophy. What they have is a desire to be immensely rich and powerful.
Hmm.
The person who was just killed in Sierra Leone, for instance.
Right. Well, now, in these stories, as you're telling them, as we see science fiction evolving, what's striking to me is that we are seeing more and more biological engineering as a reality. In fact, I think the general consensus is the biological revolution in science is what's coming next. Is that impacting your science fiction writing?
I have written science fiction that was strictly biological science fiction. As a matter of fact, I have three novels being reprinted soon. Dawn, Adulthood Rights, and Imago are being reprinted as Lilith's Brood. And that is biological science fiction because the people in those books use biotechnology instead of other kinds of technology. They don't use machines except for biological machines.
And when they use these biological machines, it's for evil.
Oh, no. No. I don't write about good and evil with this enormous dichotomy. I write about people. I write about people doing the kinds of things that people do. And, I mean, I think even the worst of us doesn't just set out to be evil. People set out to get something. They set out to defend themselves from something. They are frightened, perhaps. They set out because they believe their way is the best way to perhaps enforce their way on other people. But no, I don't write about good and evil. As a matter of fact, my new book, Parable of the Trickster, that I'm working on now, is a little bit about the idea that the whimsical, the different, the stuff happens attitude is real, is something that we have to deal with, and it's not really all that useful to just say, well, the devil made me do it.
Now, what about men and women in science fiction? Your female characters tend to be very strong characters. And for me, as a casual reader of science fiction, I'm unaccustomed to it.
Well, there's more of it now than there used to be. There are a lot more women in science fiction, and there are even a few more black women. Would you like some names?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. There is Tanana Reeve Dhu, who writes a kind of horror fantasy, which is a related genre. And there is Nalo Hopkinson, who writes science fiction. And among men, there's Stephen Barnes, who writes science fiction. And, of course, there is Samuel R. Delaney, who was one of my teachers and who's kind of the grandmaster.
Now, when you see women in science fiction, I was saying earlier, especially if you see them like on Star Trek or on some of these TV and movie shows, I never see them take the lead role. What's striking about your work is they're in the lead role.
Well, I wrote myself in. This is one of the things that I did without even thinking about it. Now, and by the way, please don't take science fiction to be limited by what you see on television and at the movies, because television and movies are always way behind. For one thing, I suspect that money is very conservative and people want to do with their money what they've seen done successfully before. So what we wind up with in the movies and television is what was done in print many years ago.
Let's talk about you for just a second.
Sure.
When I was reading about you, I was struck by the notion that you said you were a loner and someone who, from the time that you were a child in California, were creating different realities for yourself. Mm-hmm. Why was that? Tell us about what kind of child you were and what your parents did.
Well, I was an only child, and my mother was a widow very early on. I don't really have any clear memories of my father, so I was on my own a lot. And I was also, since I was on my own a lot as a very young child, I did not learn to be with other children early. And that meant that when I was finally going to school and going to child care after school, I didn't really know how to get along with other kids. But I knew how to make little worlds of my own. And that's what I did for my amusement. I told myself stories. I've been telling myself stories since I was 4 years old. When I was 10, I began writing them down. And when I was 13, I discovered how you submit stories for publication, and I began bothering editors with my stories. I got them back by return mail, of course, with rejection slips, but that's how old I was when I knew that this was what I wanted to do for a living.
But then at some point, you were frustrated, and I believe it said that you were working cleaning places when you finally...
Oh, I did all sorts of work. It wasn't a matter of frustration. It was a matter of paying the rent.
And even, I think, telephone sales, right?
Yes, yes, yes. I make a joke of that. I tell people, you know, I'm that person who called you and tried to sell you what you didn't want, and I really don't appreciate what you said to me when you answered.
But then you were fired from that job, and that's what forced you to make it or break it in terms of science fiction writing.
Well, that's what forced me to write the novels. I had been writing short stories and submitting them. I never stopped writing. It's pretty much my religion, I think. This is probably true of a great many writers. But when I began...
Octavia Butler, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll come right back, though. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. When we return, we'll continue talking about what sparks the imagination of Octavia Butler and why she writes science fiction. We'll also begin taking your calls at 800-989-8255. If you'd like to comment on the program, please do write to us. The address is Talk of the Nation, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. The zip code 20001. The email address is totn@npr.org. Please include your name and where you're writing from. At 21 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. Today we're talking with science fiction master Octavia Butler about her latest book, Parable of the Talents, and her other works. If you have a question, a comment, or a story for Octavia Butler, our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Octavia Butler, I felt like I interrupted you there. Was there something else that you wanted to add?
Oh, I think I've gone on about that enough. I really was just talking about my getting started as a writer.
Well, you know, I think lots of people would be interested to know that you have been in touch with many other science fiction writers, that in fact, Harlan Ellison is someone that was very much involved with you. Ray Bradbury is a big fan of yours.
Oh, that's nice to know. Well, Harlan was one of my teachers. I met Bradbury once, actually, but my Ray Bradbury story is actually winding up on my very first speaking engagement following him as a speaker. A terrible thing to do to some poor kid who's just written her first few books, and you know, it's impossible.
Well, I read a quote from Ray Bradbury in which he said that he remembers a story about the Egyptians, and it said that when you die and you arrive in heaven, the one question you are asked is whether or not in this real world life you had enthusiasm. And he said of Octavia Butler, she clearly has enthusiasm for what she does. So I thought that was a very nice compliment.
It is very nice.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Judith in Newport, California. Judith, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, it's Newport Beach. I loved the parable of the talent and the parable of the sower. And I was going to ask you to explain that, but you already did. Because no matter how many times I read those, your explanation in the book, I just couldn't get it. But thank you for explaining that. But what I wanted to tell you is that I drive around Southern California a lot, and there are a lot of middle-income housing projects that are getting gates and walls. And I just think to myself, oh, no, those walls aren't high enough, and, oh, they're going to have to do something about those gates.
yes.
And,
Well, you got to share with the rest of the audience. You're having these thoughts because of what you read in Octavia Butler's book.
Right, because Warren came from a gated community, and it wasn't like one of the high-class ones like in Beverly Hills. It was somewhere out here in Orange County. And there's a lot of them being built now, you know, not...
That's right.
Yeah, a lot, and with gates and walls. And, I just really wonder a lot about that. And then I think, well, can I plant a vegetable garden in my backyard? And we don't have any gates in my community. And, you know, I definitely think about your books.
Judith, why would you have to plant... Because people are hoarding food?
Because you're afraid to go to any stores. Well, especially down here in Los Angeles, in Octavia's story, you can't get to Los Angeles without being killed, mostly.
And, oh, come on now. Oh, my. Well, I lived there for a while. I wouldn't say that. But I'll
No, she
you,
said in your no, book, Octavia.
Oh, I see. Book. I see. When I began working on Parable of the Sower, I didn't know anybody who lived in a gated community. By the time I finished the book, at least one of my friends had moved into a gated community. So I know what you mean. And this is just an ordinary middle-class person. She was a teacher.
Yeah.
And there are more and more of them, as you say.
There are. But then I sometimes wonder if that is going to be a cause. Rather than, it turns into a solution in your book of sorts.
No, it never becomes a solution.
It doesn't. People breach the walls, and then Lauren begins her journey. But it seems, you know, then I don't know. It's just like your book haunts me. I mean, no matter where I go, I see.
I'm glad of that because it is a cautionary tale.
Definitely.
It is a book that says if we keep doing what we're doing, here's what we might wind up with. I've heard people call it prophecy, and I generally respond to that with horror because certainly I don't want it to be prophecy.
Absolutely.
I don't want to live in that world.
No. No, we don't want it to be prophecy, but it definitely is a cautionary tale. But it is frightening how accurate a lot of your scenes and ideas are. I mean, and then up in Northern California and all that. I don't know. You know, I'm really glad it finally had a happy-ish ending. But
Well, my endings are always hopeful. I used to worry that I was a pessimist, but I realized that I couldn't seem to write a story that ended in a pessimistic way.
Well, Judith, thanks for your call. Let me say for the listeners that, in fact, the story is set in the year 2032, and it's kind of what I think you refer to it, Miss Butler, as an installment plan World War III.
Well, one of my characters refers to it that way. It is something that, well, it's a matter of a kind of an avalanche of results. All the things that we ignore, some of them you've mentioned, drugs, global warming becoming more and more of a problem, and it's not just a matter of drought, it's all the effects of global warming all over the world.
Combined with gated communities, rapes,
yes,
murders.
Gated communities.
You have people being taken by the officials, just disappearing.
Mm-hmm,
you have people hiding food and weapons. There are no public schools.
Exactly. People decide, politicians decide that public schools are an experiment that didn't work. So in many cases, there aren't any more.
And you have slavery.
Yes. Well, slavery never really left. It just kind of, it quieted down a bit. It went underground, but in a lot of places, in a lot of countries, for instance, debt slavery is still around and legal.
But you have slavery in the United States.
Yes, yeah, and there is slavery here now. Every now and then, there's a news story about a new place where slavery has been discovered. But in this story, slavery becomes almost legal. It becomes not so much slavery as indenture. You can become an indentured person because you're broke.
I have a number of questions coming out of what you said. Do you mean like things like sweatshops and people being brought, like you have Chinese immigrants brought in the bowels of some ship?
Remember the women from, I believe, Thailand,
right,
who were discovered working for nothing and being forced to work horrible hours and generally being kept locked up.
But in your book, what you have is literally collars on people that
yes,
you know, administer shocks, pleasure, mm-hmm, pain. And so they're enslaved in that way.
When I created the collars, I didn't know about the electronic belts, the prisoner control devices that were coming into existence. And they were just coming along as I was writing the first of these books. And I realized in the second book, when I intended to introduce collars, that I had to not just introduce the collar, but make it a descendant, a kind of technological descendant of the current belts. The belts are pretty basic. I mean, they hurt you. And the collars are more sophisticated. They can even make you feel good. They can play you like an accordion or something. So it's a fairly nasty situation, and it's one that some people envy the dead when they find themselves in that situation.
Let's go to Rachel in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Rachel, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having such a wonderful show today, Juan. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Octavia Butler is, in my humble opinion, the very best fiction writer today.
Thank you.
Parable of Sower, Parable of Talents, in my political theory classes. And her work really encourages students to think about political participation and what it means and what realities can happen and might happen. I guess the question I have is, number one, what are some of, Octavia, what are some of your favorite political novels? And are there any movie deals in the works? And when does Parable of Trickster come out?
Well, Parable from the last backward, Parable of the Trickster is not written yet. I'm working on it. It's doing what all my novels do at the beginning. It's giving me trouble. So it probably will be written either by the end of this year or sometime in the first part of next year.
Okay.
As for movie deals, my book Kindred is usually under option. It is now.
Mm-hmm.
My book, Parable of the Sower, is optioned sometimes. As a matter of fact, most of my books have been optioned at one time or another. But you realize that a movie option just means that someone is buying the right to shop it around and see if they can put together a deal,
mm-hmm,
to make the movie.
Have you talked with Spike Lee yet?
So far, no one's put together the deal.
Okay.
Ms. Butler, I think she asked if you had spoken to Spike Lee, or I guess she's thinking of black filmmakers.
Well, I have, but not formally. I mean, we met at an event where we were both talking, but not as a matter of is he going to make the movie? Probably not. I mean, I haven't heard anything.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind, but I haven't heard anything.
It's a great idea.
Oh, and as for novels that I've enjoyed, I mean, the only political novel that comes immediately to mind is the obvious one, 1984,
mm-hmm.
which I read on my own before it was required reading at school. And, of course, the other Animal Farm. I don't know that political novels have influenced me as much as just being a news junkie has influenced me. I read and hear the news a lot, more than I should, more than is good for me, I suspect.
I read about you that you liked to read science fiction magazines when you were a kid.
Oh, I did. But I mean now, I don't seem to be able to avoid the news. As a matter of fact, Juan Williams, I listen to your show.
Well, thanks, Octavia.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Thank you. Can you talk about your political agenda that you may or may not have about that you've used with these two books? I mean, there clearly is a vision that some say we are quickly moving towards. Even
now,
if we embrace compassionate conservatism, some can say that we're moving in that direction. And I was wondering if you felt comfortable addressing that.
I don't really. My political agenda doesn't quite sound right. It sounds as though I'm trying to, as I said, put forward prophecy with these novels. These novels are not prophetic. These novels are cautionary tales. These novels are, if we are not careful, you know, if we carry on as we have been, this is what we might wind up with. The problems that I write about are problems that we can do something about. That's why I write about them. We don't have to have the educational problem that we have now, and we certainly shouldn't give up on public education, although I've heard surprising numbers of people talk as though that's what we should do. They don't have an alternative. They just think, well, public education doesn't work, so why bother paying for it?
Well, I think that is increasingly the attitude in this country. But I wanted
that's
to challenge
terrifying.
You. Well,
yes.
It's terrifying as in science fiction, isn't it, in a way?
Well, it's terrifying in real life. Right. I mean, you have to think about what kind of world you want to live in. And I don't think there's a person alive who would want to live in the world that I've written about.
Hmm.
But we can arrange it.
Well, in fact, I was going to challenge you on the notion you said you didn't really write about power relationships, but I think you do. I think Pattern Master, in which you write about a ruling class that's joined together through telepathy, that's a ruling class. That's a power elite.
Yes, I said I didn't write prophecy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
I think you definitely write political. There's a
strong
political content.
Oh, yes, I write quite a bit about power.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't mentioned it until now, but yes, one of the reasons I got into writing about power was because I grew up feeling that I didn't have any. And therefore, it was fascinating. I get into all sorts of things. I go to the library and graze. I buy courses on tape so that I can listen to them when I travel. I do all sorts of things. And I have a course that I just recently bought on tape, and I've been listening to it on this particular trip. One of the people spoken about in the course is Hegel. And it was fascinating to hear his ideas of might makes right.
Hmm.
Of course, never put that bluntly. I must have been made to read some Hegel when I was in school, but it's, you know, how some of the things you read in school are forgotten as soon as you're out of that particular class.
True.
And having it all brought back to me now, you know, how wonderfully cleverly he went about saying that whatever is going on is what's supposed to be going on. Whoever's on top, that's who's supposed to be on top. I find myself still interested in power relationships and still writing about them, not so much any longer because I worry about not having power myself, but just because they are part of what it means to be human.
Right.
And I do write about different ways of being human.
Let me remind the listeners that they're listening to Talk of the Nation, from NPR News. Let's go to Angie in Portland, Oregon. Angie, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks, Angie.
Octavia, first of all, I just wanted to comment on your use of science fiction to make some commentary on modern society and offer what you see as problems and offer potential solutions. And I really appreciate your views. I think I share a lot of them. But what for me makes a tale like that so effective is its ability to move the reader. I read fiction because I love the tale. I love the story. And I've read a lot of utopian, dystopian novels that certainly are kind of coming from my perspective, but they leave me feeling kind of hollow. And what I appreciate most about your characters, especially the protagonists of the Parable series and Kindred, is this incredible affinity I feel for them. I feel about them kind of the way I would an old friend. And my question is, do you do that on purpose? Do you set out to create that relationship between your character and the reader, or is it just your talent as a writer?
I do, Angie. I like to read novels that I can get involved in, and I like to write novels that involve other people. We can never know one another as well as we can know a fictional character, because we can get into the fictional character's mind.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really enjoy reading the kind of novel that keeps me outside the character.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So since I don't enjoy reading it, I don't write it.
Well, I really appreciate your books. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Angie. You know, Ms. Butler, I was thinking to myself that part of this is the idea of, in fact, seeing people who are friends in your real life, black people, Asians, mm-hmm. Hispanics, suddenly pop up in science fiction. Why were they absent before?
They weren't entirely absent. I came along at what was for me a very good time. I went to a Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in 1970.
We only have about 30 seconds before this break, so if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, and that's one of the places that we learned to be more inclusive and of women and whatever. I can't help being more inclusive myself just because I have to write myself in.
All right. We're going to take a short break right now. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. My guest is the writer Octavia Butler. When we return, we'll continue talking about her short stories and novels, and we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join the discussion online, you can go to our website at www.npr.org. Click on the Your Turn section, then scroll down to Talk of the Nation. At 40 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide at www.alcatel.com. The W. Alton Jones Foundation, supporting public understanding of the importance of healthy ecosystems for people's lives, www.wajones.org. And the Ford Foundation, a resource for people and institutions worldwide. This is NPR National Public Radio.
It has been two decades since the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. Later today, we'll revisit one site of the volcano's destruction.
It literally destroyed everything in its path, including the virgin forest, the trailer house and the car that were here, and every remnant of modern civilization was destroyed in a matter of a few moments.
I'm Noah Adams. Join us for NPR's All Things Considered.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look back at the May 18, 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens and how the area has recovered from the largest volcanic eruption in the lower 48 states in the past century. Today we're talking with one of science fiction's most acclaimed writers, Octavia Butler. If you want to join our conversation, if you have a question or comment for Ms. Butler, please call us at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Ms. Butler, I want to throw a question in there as if I was a caller. I noticed that you are very interested in religion, and especially in creating religion and in fanatics, fanaticism. Is this a concern? Are you worried about fanaticism and about the growth of new religion in American society?
Oh, well, no, not exactly. These two novels are specifically concerned with religion. They were intended to be. Of course, fanaticism is a problem, especially the kind of scapegoating fanaticism that points out who's responsible for all the trouble and wants to do something about it. In these novels, I think I take advantage of the reality that there are no human communities without religion. I mean, there may be human communities that don't acknowledge a specific god, but they've found some way of creating religion, either secular or sacred. And in this case, my character looks around and says, well, why shouldn't religion be used for something? Why shouldn't it be a tool? Why shouldn't religion take us where perhaps other things can't take us? The religion that she creates is called Earthseed. And she says, the destiny of Earthseed is to take root among the stars. She gives people a goal. It is a difficult goal. It's a long-term goal. It's like during the Middle Ages, you know, the goal of building a cathedral. You could begin a cathedral, but surely you wouldn't live to see its end.
Well, what's the difference between that religion and, let's say, Judaism or Catholicism or any of the Protestant religions?
Well, basically, her people get to go to heaven while they're alive, the ones who go. She does feel that the destiny of Earthseed is to take root among the stars, that if we are to be anything other than smooth dinosaurs, we'd better get out there. And the best way for us to get out there is to create the huge family of projects that it will take to get us out there. She is not about colonialism or anything like that. She's just about sort of taking out some human insurance.
What's the difference between what she's doing and a cult?
Well, any religion, I would suppose, could be called a cult when it gets going.
But the degree of intensity, I suspect, is different. You know, Jim Jones is a little different than the Pope.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Although the Pope didn't begin as the Pope. I mean, that began as a small cult among the Jews. The Christianity began as a small cult among the Jews. So, I mean, most religions begin as cults just because they're small.
Right.
Few adherents, not a great deal of understanding from the outside world, that kind of thing. My character begins with a few people, some of whom believe in what she's saying and some of whom just want to be warm and well-fed.
Okay. Let me go to Michael in St. Louis. Michael, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi.
How you doing, Juan?
Fine, thanks, Michael.
Hello, Ms. Butler. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you on the show.
Thank you, Michael.
I've read all your books twice over. And I want to speak to that in terms of the realism and the sort of compellingness of the books that once you start reading them, you can't put them down. And I was wondering, because of the fact that, like, there's so much unrealistic views of the future in science, and it's been glamorized so much in movies and TV, do you think that people have a total misconception of how things may be in the future
I don't think any of us can know how things will be in the future. We're creating the future, but we can't see it clearly. We can only try to make it better.
I understand that. And one of the points I wanted to try and comment on was, like, because of the fact that so many in the media and the way the future is depicted in movies and so forth, a lot of people are excluded, and there's a, like I said, a limited sort of view. And your writing sort of includes everybody in all situations and everything social. And maybe, would you say that that's one of the reasons why, like, the lady earlier referred to some of your writing as almost like prophecy?
Oh, I'm not sure she put it that way, but my writing is inclusive. I write about people, and I mean, the differences fascinate me as much as the similarities. I come from Southern California, and I've never lived in a segregated community, and I think that helped me to recognize that everybody's out there.
You know, but one of the descriptions
One thing more. I don't know whether I'd said this before, but in my writing, when I began writing science fiction back when I was 12 years old, everybody I read about in science fiction was white, and most of the people I read about in science fiction were male. So I really did have to write myself in.
What I was going to say to you was that in reading about you, your personal biography as opposed to your works, mm-hmm. I noticed that you said oftentimes you personally feel like an outsider, and that as a child you were tall, you were 6 feet tall, and that you felt, even though you were living in an integrated community, as if you were off to the side.
I was off to the side. I was as socially awkward as they come. A lot of science fiction writers come from socially awkward, physically unusual young people who grow into their physical presence, but who by then have been hooked by writing science fiction. And I was definitely one of those. When I went to a science fiction writer's workshop, I found that the people that I met there, even though they came in different races and sexes, were very much like me in that one respect. They were outcasts, too.
All right. Let's take a bunch of calls here. Let's go to Elizabeth in Minneapolis. Elizabeth, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello. I had the opportunity to meet Octavia Butler in Minneapolis during a convention. However, I was blind at the time, and I couldn't find anyone to take me to you. However, oh. I do have a question about your insight into the people in the Pattern Master series who are latents, and they act in such a way that makes them look as if they're mentally ill. And I gleaned from that they were just so sensitive that they had to maybe abuse alcohol and drugs in order to dampen the hurt. That's my
exactly.
insight. If you have a different insight, I'll listen to it off the air.
Well, Elizabeth, hang on before you go. You said you were blind at the time?
I had eye surgery, and I couldn't find anyone to take me to Octavia Butler to ask her this exact question.
I wish I had known, my goodness.
But you've recovered?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Well, okay, thanks for your call, Elizabeth.
I'll take it off the mm-hmm. air. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. The latents in, for the most part, Mind of My Mind, are people who have telepathic abilities or other abilities and are not in control of them, don't necessarily understand them, and are suffering from them very much as though they were mentally ill. What's the difference, after all, from somebody who has real telepathic ability and hears the thoughts of others and someone who's schizophrenic and hears voices? They don't know, and they suffer, and they do abuse alcohol and drugs because they're just trying to quiet the voices.
Let's go to Bill in Somerville, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Juan. Hi, Octavia.
Hi.
Hi there.
A comment and then a question. The comment is that so often science fiction writers never challenge the potential of the discipline. They simply project a dominant culture that we're in this historical moment with more gadgets. And what I love about Octavia's writing is she looks at the full human potential so that her science fiction isn't just technical science, but it's social science fiction, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here's the question. In your Lilith trilogy, the folks who you call the Huancali tell Lilith that humans have an inherent conflict in them, which if they had not intervened would have led to human extinction. And I'm wondering if you believe that that, if in fact that's your voice speaking, do you believe that that conflict exists? And do you see a means of managing it?
Bill, thanks for your call.
The conflict, by the way, or the contradiction, is that human beings are intelligent, but also that they are hierarchical, and that their hierarchical tendencies are a lot older than their intelligence, and the hierarchical tendencies are sometimes in charge. And I emphasize this by having the story begin after a terrible war that has wiped out a good portion of humanity. The hierarchical tendencies have obviously been in charge at that point, and we've just about one-upped ourselves to death. Do I think that's true? I suspect that it might be. Not necessarily exactly like that, but that we do seem sometimes much more interested in one-upping each other, one-upping one country over the other, than in doing ourselves some long-term good.
All right, let me remind the listeners that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ms. Butler, it does sound as though you believe in sort of a genetic destiny. There's certain things in our genes, such as a love of hierarchies, that we can't get away from.
Not a love of hierarchies, hierarchical tendencies, the kinds of things that you can find in the lowest kinds of plants and animals. And I remember one of the things that inspired that particular description of the problem, watching a nature show on PBS, in which two clones of algae grew on a rock, and as they grew round the rock, they met. And it wasn't a matter of, oh, pardon me, now I'll grow upward, but it was a matter of one poisoning the other.
Huh.
One-upsmanship. So I'm not talking about anything organized, and I'm not talking about anything evil. I'm just talking about a tendency.
All right. Let's go to Nisi in Seattle, Washington. Nisi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi there. Hi, Octavia. How you doing?
Hi there.
Good show. I wanted to ask you, I know that you've been a student at Clarion, the Writers' Workshop, and an instructor. I wanted you to talk about the value of critique groups after workshops, and I wondered why you'd never belong to one.
Ah, that's probably not a good question to ask me, Nisi, because I reached a point of not needing critique groups, but needing instead to focus on doing my own work and getting it out, mailing it out. Sometimes you do reach that point where your career is getting critiqued instead of getting the work out.
Did you actually belong to a critique group at one point and found that it was less valuable as your career went on?
Two or three of them, yes, I did. And it wasn't a matter of as my career went on. It was a matter of if I was going to have a career, I had better go home and write.
Nisi, thanks for your call. Ms. Butler, is science fiction moving in new directions?
I think it usually is. I mean, by nature, not necessarily new prophecies or brand new. For instance, the more we learn about, just about anything, nanotechnology.
Just briefly,
the more
we
can
have to
write
go.
About it.
All
okay,
right.
The more we learn about anything, the more we can write about it, and the more we can consider what will happen if we keep doing what we're doing.
Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank all of you who called this hour, and especially my guest, Octavia Butler. Her newest book is Parable of the Talents. She joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Thanks for being with us.